Part 2. Madame André. The best people possess a feeling for beauty, the courage to take risks, the discipline to tell the truth, the capacity for sacrifice. Ironically, their virtues make them vulnerable. They are often wounded, sometimes destroyed. Ernest Hemingway. Madame André. Chaudaigu Plateau, Cantal, France, March 2nd, 1944.
Gaspar! What the hell are you doing in that uniform?
My French is best when I'm angry, and the words ring across the plateau, furious and clear. His head snaps up, and I can feel those beady little eyes zero in on me beneath the brim of his cap. He goes perfectly still. I recognize him now that he's stepped into the bright ring of firelight. What I can't make sense of is why he's dressed as a brown shirt. Hubert is beside me now, weapon leveled at Gaspar's head, bending toward my pack. He grabs my revolver and hands it to me in a single smooth movement. For all his appearances of being gangly and uncoordinated, the man can move like a quicksilver when the urge strikes him. I feel better with the revolver in my hand. I've grown to like the solid weight of it, the wood grain in my palm and cool gunmetal against my finger. This fascination with weaponry is one of the many surprises my new life has brought, and I am not unaware that, despite all my training, this is the first time I've ever pointed my revolver at a living person. Undaunted, I pull the hammer back with the pad of my thumb.
"Explain yourself," I tell Gaspar.
All around us, the shadows begin to move as Fournier's men step from their hiding places at the tree line and shift toward the bonfire. Those who have weapons raise them, and those who do not stand in solidarity with their brothers. 50 poorly armed men now seem a great advantage against 5. Gaspar is an odious pig of a man, but he is not stupid. He recognizes that he is outnumbered and lowers his weapon.
"You," he says, with such loathing that he may as well have spit a glob of mucus onto the toe of my boot. "What are you doing here?" Hubert demands.
"We thought you were Germans. We meant to kill you and take your weapons."
"Yes, but did you plan to seduce us first?"
Oh, how badly Gaspar wants to shoot me. His entire body is quivering with rage. But Hubert takes a step forward, not quite placing himself between us, but letting Gaspar know he'll have to go through him to get to me.
"And finding that we are not, in fact, Germans," Hubert says, "what is your plan now?"
Gaspar flicks his tongue to the corner of his mouth.
"I intend to depart in peace."
"I believe nothing you say while in that uniform."
I nod toward his waist.
"Where did you get that whip?"
Seeing no other way out of his predicament, Gaspar finally relents.
"We ambushed a German supply line 4 days ago near Le Puy. We took their weapons and vehicles. Then we stripped these uniforms from their stinking corpses."
He raises a hand, palm out so as not to alarm us by the movement, and then slowly lifts the collar of his shirt to reveal a bloody bullet hole. From the corner of my eye, I can see Hubert study my face. "Do you believe him?" That's what his expression says. He is waiting for me to decide. They all are. Not a single one of the Frenchmen who flank me has so much as moved a muscle. The realization that I am well and truly in charge is so startling that I have to keep my lips pressed together so my mouth won't hang open. I am not ready to let Gaspar off the hook this easily, however. I glare at him for a moment longer, and only when the plateau is so quiet that I can hear the crickets chirping again do I turn to Hubert and nod once. Then I release the hammer on my revolver and place it back in the holster at my thigh. None of the men around me follow suit. Though I have declared a truce, they will not let their guard down.
"You won't find what you're looking for here," I tell Gaspar. Visibly relaxed, he turns from me and surveys the 6 open crates scattered across the plateau and the piles of weapons beside them. After a moment, he returns that calculating gaze of his to me.
I see much here that I desire. You had your chance to work with us. Come, Madame André, do not be unreasonable.
It is the weak-minded man's retort, a thing he says when thwarted by a woman, an excuse, a bit of intellectual poverty. He doesn't like me, therefore I am unreasonable, a femme stupide.
Va te faire foutre, I say.
His eyes widen, his jaw clenches. I get the impression that no woman has ever dared speak to him like this.
You're not the only English rat crawling these hills. I'll get my weapons from someone else.
He pauses here, then leans in for the kill.
No, you're no rat like Victor and Patrice. You are la souris blanche, aren't you?
The white mouse. Merde. Gaspar knows. I ignore the question and remain perfectly still without emotion as I say, there is one thing I require before you get your filthy carcass off my mountain. He snorts.
I don't take orders from you.
You will, in fact, and you will learn that soon enough. But first, the uniforms, yours and those of your men. I didn't care for them on the Germans and I like them even less on you.
As-tu perdu ton putain d'esprit?
My mind is quite intact. And if you are not a collaborationist, as you claim, you will have no issues surrendering those uniforms to be burned. You can leave here without them, or you can face a firing squad. The one behind me will do just fine.
Boudin,
he spits. I sigh. Have you no imagination at all? Ugly? Is that the best insult you can come up with? I would expect more creativity from a man who wants to lead others into battle. The 4 men behind him are shifting uneasily as we glare at each other. But I am out of patience. I pull my revolver from my holster and raise it once again.
The uniforms, now!
Gaspar opens his mouth to argue, or perhaps to deliver a better insult, but I pull the hammer back with my thumb.
Please give me an excuse to shoot you. I regret not doing so last time I had the chance.
Hubert takes a step forward, followed by a handful of Fournier's men.
Do as she says.
Gaspar is out of options, but he doesn't tremble at the edge of the firelight. He walks directly toward me and looks me right in the eyes as he tosses the whip onto the fire.
Do you know what it means, that whip?
He asks as the edges begin to blacken.
No.
He chucks the brown hat into the flames as well, and then goes to work on the buttons of his shirt, never once looking away from my face.
It's a sign of Hitler's favor, something he gives to his officers. They are called Obersturmführer, senior storm leaders. They are the ones he has pulled from prisons and gangs and mental institutions. Murderers, rapists, thieves, child molesters. They are chosen specifically for their depravity and then given whips so they can be let loose upon whatever victims please the Gestapo, usually Jews. The man I took this from had a pocket full of children's teeth.
I think of Vienna and the water wheel, of Obersturmführer Wolf. What was his name, the man you took this from?
I didn't ask. Gaspar says through gritted teeth.
The world will be a better place without Wolf, but I want to be the one to kill him. I want that satisfaction. I am torn between hope that he is rotting in the ground somewhere, unable to hurt anyone else, and jealousy that Gaspar might have gotten to him first. Behind him, Gaspar's men begin to peel their uniforms off, though they are not quite so bold about it. They hover beyond the ring of firelight. They ball their clothing and throw it as near the fire as they can get. Hubert kicks each piece into the flames. But Gaspar is in a rage now, pulling off his boots, yanking at his belt, bending over so I can see the top of his broad, hairy arse.
I don't regret killing them, he shouts. Nor should you. And I don't regret using their filthy, disgusting uniforms to get what I need to arm my men so I can kill more of them.
He stands before me now, in his skivvies, in the cold night air. His jaw is clenched, his eyes wild.
Just don't make an enemy of me in the process, I say.
He leaves then, without a word, and his men skulk off after him, wearing nothing but socks and underwear. Hubert and I remain still as the engines roar to life. Fournier joins us from where he's been watching at the other side of the fire. None of us speak as they drive away. My arm aches from holding the revolver. I am cold. I am exhausted from being up half the night. And yet I stand there, unable to hide my grin as I imagine Gaspar and his men walking back into Chateau Montmouchet. Fournier is shaking with mirth beside me. Hoots, whistles, and laughter float up from the tree line. Someone claps. I can feel Hubert's gaze burrowing into the back of my skull, so I turn and face him.
What? I assume that you have a plan when it comes to Gaspar?
I do, in fact. But even he cannot quite suppress the wry smile that tugs at the corner of his mouth.
And is humiliating him part of it?
Oh no, that was just for sport.
I return my revolver to its holster and stretch my arm. He is a reckless, arrogant brute, a liability to everything we're doing here.
Agreed. But what is your plan?
I will bring him to heel.
Hubert is quiet as I drive back to Chateau de Coufour. The sky is only now beginning to lighten, and Dennis Rake is sprawled out on the back seat of the little Renault, one arm draped across his face like a swooning Victorian. The effect is somewhat ruined by his snoring, however. I am tempted to open the window and wake him with a blast of cold air, but he's exhausted. We all are, after unpacking and cleaning weapons late into the night. Our orders from London were to arrive at the plateau at 10 in the evening and be gone by 4 the next morning to avoid detection. Easier said than done, as it turns out. But Fournier's first group of men has their weapons, and everyone seems to be happy. Except Hubert. He's scowling at the windshield.
You make me nervous when you think, I tell him.
And you make me nervous when you don't.
What is that supposed to mean?
You let Gaspar go.
What was I supposed to do, arrest him? Shoot him? He's an absurd, arrogant, disgusting prick, but he's not a collaborationist.
He's trouble, Hubert says.
Indeed, but he also commands 4,000 men spread across the Auvergne. We can't be starting a civil war between him and Fournier. We're on the same side of this bloody war.
He goes quiet again, popping his knuckles one by one, first the fingers on his left hand, then the right.
Still, I don't like it.
Oh.
I finally realized what's troubling him.
He knows our location.
Hubert nods.
It's no secret at all. The plateau and Chateau de Coufour are only 5 kilometers apart, maybe a bit less.
Which means Gaspar can find us easily.
Or lead someone else to us, Hubert says.
You think he'd really report us to the Germans?
He shrugs.
I have no idea what that man might do.
The sun won't be up for another hour, and the sky has that wet wool look, like rain is coming in from the west. The road is full of potholes, and the steering wheel on the Renault is loose. But I turn my head and look at Hubert anyway. His gaze is fixed on mine, and he sits there, hands now still and resting in his lap, waiting for me to come to the same conclusion that he's already reached. My mind is numb and flaccid after being up all night. It takes only a moment longer, and I'm furious with myself for not taking stock of the situation earlier.
Mad!
I scream, pounding the flat of my hand against the steering wheel.
We have to move camp!
It was too much to hope for, I suppose, being able to weather the war safe and sound inside the Chateau de Coufour.
but at least our host is coming with us. I like Fournier. He was a hotel executive before the war and then fled to the country when the Germans invaded, bringing his cheerful wife and a small fortune with him. The money, long gone, was put to good use arming his maquisard, but his wife is kept hidden and safe in a remote village whose location he refuses to share even with me. I stuff my possessions into my pack as Hubert stands at the door of my room. We did allow ourselves one last comfortable sleep this morning when we got back from the drop zone, but it's late afternoon now, and we have to be on our way. At least Fournier provided us a lunch of bread, soft apples, and fresh milk. There's a cow hidden somewhere on the property, and she must be happy and well fed because the milk was thick with cream. I should have known we couldn't stay, I grumble as I zip my pack. Large manor homes make easy targets, Hubert says. Yes, but they also come equipped with proper beds and fully stocked wine cellars. I give one last longing look toward the mattress and follow Hubert from the chateau. Dennis Rake is waiting for us in the back seat of the Renault. He is unshaved, unhappy, and underwhelmed with our new plan.
You mean to tell me we are actually going to camp out in the woods with these men?
He scowls at me, unaware of how comical he looks sitting there, holding the transmitter and radio to his chest like a couple of teddy bears. I toss my pack onto the seat beside him, climb in, and start the engine. I offer my best, most charming grin, the one Henri loves, making certain to flash my dimple.
Not at all. Camping implies a short period of time. 1 week, perhaps two. We're going to be living out there, rough as guts.
Although I can't be certain, I suspect that Rake is assailing me in Hungarian by the way he spits out a slew of guttural words. Any idea what he's saying? I ask. Hubert shakes his head in the seat beside me.
Not a word.
Probably best.
And then we're off, following Fournier as he leads us to a remote encampment. Though his headquarters are at the Chateau de Coufour, his men are spread out in small groups throughout the Cantal. He's arranged each with a leader who answers directly to him and dispersed them widely so as not to be vulnerable to attack. Still, each of Fournier's camps has specific needs, and I must assess them one by one in order to arm them properly. It will take weeks. We drive for over 20 minutes, maneuvering our way through the foothills and then up ever higher until we reach the spot chosen by Fournier as our base for the foreseeable future. This is the farthest end of the Chaudaigu Plateau and is home to one of his larger groups, populated by over 200 men. The plateau commands all the other surrounding mountains and valleys, and Fournier's maquis control every path, track, and road that leads up to it. His men are embedded in the strongest position in the entire district, and they use it to their advantage. Despite being remote, its elevation should provide an excellent radio signal for our daily transmissions to London. Fournier directs us into a clearing and cuts his engine. We climb out of our vehicles and find six smouldering cook fires and a handful of men eating what I fear might be the remains of a horse. Once they recognize Fournier, a series of whistles are sent up and dozens more men materialize between the trees. Some hold weapons, but most don't. As I look around the clearing, it occurs to me that there is not a single shelter or tent to be seen, only these men, wearing what they have. The ground is damp, the men are haggard, and everyone is staring at us. I feel out of place in my wool slacks and red lipstick.
I'll just explain to them who you are, Fournier says, then jogs off to speak with one of his lieutenants.
Hubert is an army man and accustomed to harsh conditions. Even still, his shoulders slump and he glowers at the cook fire. He mutters something under his breath and stomps off after Fournier.
You can't be serious, Rake hisses in my ear.
He is an aristocrat, fond of his luxuries, and is dubious about this entire situation.
Where are we going to sleep?
I flash him a wicked grin. I call dibs on the car.
Fine, but what are we going to eat?
We both look back to the campfire, where Hubert is standing, now pointing angrily at the carcass.
Not that, I say.
Have you ever seen Hubert so worked up? He asks. I didn't actually know he was capable of emotions. And yet there he is, face red, voice a low rumble.
Rake snorts.
I still find it funny that Buckmaster put you two together.
Because I have all the emotions?
On a regular basis.
We watch Hubert, amazed.
Finally, at a loss for any other explanation, Rake shrugs.
He must love horses.
Madame André?
Fournier shouts, waving me over. Come along then, I tell Rake. We're being summoned. As we trudge through the clearing, Rake takes in the various groups of men scattered near the trees, then leans in and whispers, "They're all staring at you."
"Jealous?"
He glares at me.
"Have they never seen a woman before?"
It's true. Fournier's men are staring. They have been since we stepped out of the Renault. The more men who have entered the clearing, the more curious eyes I've felt upon my person. They are shameless in their surveil.
Not in a long time, I'd wager.
Careful, ducky. That could be an issue. I march ahead, chin high.
Only if I let it.
When we reach the fire, Hubert turns to me, hands tucked deep into his pockets, and says,
"We have a problem."
"More than one, apparently, by the look on your face. But start with the most urgent."
"Your friend does not like the, arrangements my men have made for feeding themselves," Fournier says.
"Arrangements?" I ask.
"Normally, my men maintain a steady diet of forest mushrooms, sep, they're called, along with whatever game they can catch, mostly fish and quail, with the occasional old horse thrown in for good measure," he says,
and I shudder, then brave a glance at Rake. That confirms our suspicions.
"But the Cantal is littered with small farms and villages."
"So?"
"So," Hubert interrupts, "these men have been raiding farms at night, stealing pigs and chickens, pillaging root cellars."
He points at the carcass beside the first.
"Did you not notice it's still wearing a saddle?"
I hadn't, in fact. I was too distracted by the grotesque bared teeth inside the blackened skull. Hubert continues.
"They pluck clothing right off the line and milk the dairy cows before their owners can get to them. They've become a plague throughout the Cantal."
Fournier is clearly embarrassed at this revelation, but he tries to defend his men nonetheless.
"And who do you think is protecting those very farms and villages from the Germans? My men. What are they supposed to do? Sit out here and starve to death?"
It's clear most of these men don't speak English. Their heads whip back and forth from Hubert to Fournier to me. They are uncertain who is in charge. I look at each of them in turn and say very clearly, in French, "Leave us alone. We need to speak with Fournier." None of them move. In fact, from the way their spines stiffen and their fists clench, it looks as if they are growing roots right into the ground. To be given an order by a woman? The insult.
"Allez!"
Fournier snaps, and they look at him, startled, before glaring and stomping off.
"You cannot let your men steal from their neighbors," I say, "or you will be fighting two wars.
Much more of that," I point to the saddle, "and your countrymen will be after you with pitchforks." He gnaws at the side of his lip and looks somewhere beyond my left shoulder. He cannot bring himself to make eye contact as he says,
"I can't afford to feed them."
And this is why I volunteered to come back to France, to be tossed out of an airplane, to sleep on the ground and be deprived of basic luxuries.
"But I can," I say.
His eyes lock into place at this bit of news.
"Pardon?"
"Well, to be specific, England can afford to feed your men, but the money will come through me."
"I don't understand," he says.
"Starting today, I want you to instruct your men as follows.
Let them take whatever they like from the Germans. Food, clothing, vehicles, lifeblood, all of that is fair game. But they are not to steal one more thing from their countrymen. Every time you take from your neighbours, you erode their trust, and we need them. Living out here is no excuse to take advantage of the only allies you have. We need their loyalty and their information, understand? They see and hear things we don't, and we can't have them keeping it from us out of spite. I will request money for you and your men along with the weapons, and I will distribute it among your groups according to need. They can buy their provisions from these farmers at market rates, do you understand? He nods. There will be no exceptions to this rule. He nods again. Good. Go tell your men. He blinks at me once and then trots off, assuming I mean right this moment. Well, I huff out a breath and turn in a slow circle, staring back at the little clusters of men gathered around the clearing. This will be interesting. I wake just before dawn with a full bladder and the uncomfortable realization that I am surrounded on all sides by 200 sex-starved Frenchmen. In my experience, this particular species is undaunted even when regularly serviced, but the men around me haven't seen or touched a woman in months, possibly years. Rake was correct. This could be an issue. The greater problem, however, is the urgent need to relieve myself. There is little chance of falling back to sleep now, so I decide that I may as well kill two birds with one stone. Hubert teased me mercilessly back in London when he heard that I planned to bring my red satin pillow, a toothbrush, and a hefty supply of toothpaste with me on this mission. "Bloody waste of space," he said. "You'll drop straight to the ground with all that weight in your pack." I'd patted his stomach and laughed. "It doesn't weigh half so much as your spare tire." And that had been the end of it. Until last night, when he caught sight of me blissfully brushing my teeth beside the stream. I like to think he was sick with envy when I laid my head on that pillow inside the Renault, while he laid his on a clump of dried grass beside the campfire. The fire has gone out now, and my companions are snoring. This will never do long term, but we will figure out better accommodations later. I sit up and stretch my aching back, push my hair away from my face and peer out of the car window. I am the only person awake. There won't be a better time, so I push the door open, grab my pack, and pick my way through the camp. I head toward the gentle trickling stream beyond the pines. The stream bank is dotted with clumps of waist-high brush, gorse, I think, and I move carefully, looking for a good spot. It's at times like these that I wish I'd been born a man. How wonderful it must be to shift your trousers and stand up to pee. But no, women have to go bare-assed and vulnerable, in the cold. Not to mention the issue of aiming. Just thinking about the indignity makes me angry. I've been in this situation before, and I didn't like it any better then. Best to just get it over with. I squat, and then I wait. It takes only a few seconds, but as expected, the bushes around me begin to shake. The men hiding inside are trying to get a better view. I knew it. I just knew it. I could feel all those leering eyes watch me as I headed to the stream last night. They'd marked my preferred location and formed a plan. Part of me can't blame them. My presence has created quite a stir. They are curious and incorrigible. But still, this is unacceptable. I slide my hand into my pack, withdraw my revolver, and stand. I like to think they are disappointed to see that my trousers are still in place. "You can come out now," I say. The bushes continue to wriggle, but no one emerges. "If that's how you prefer to do this." I aim my revolver at the ground in front of the nearest patch of brush and fire a single shot. It's like startling a pack of geese. Men spring out of the earth all around me. Some throw themselves on the ground to begin scrambling away. Others shoot straight up several feet into the air. A handful dart into the woods, but most freeze when I yell, "Arrêtez!"
I'm fairly certain that one man has pissed himself. His trousers are dark and damp around the crotch. Pity. He won't fare well against the Germans if that's what happens when he hears a gunshot. And that's when Hubert, Reich, and Fournier burst through the trees, weapons raised, heads whipping back and forth, trying to find the cause of the commotion.
What the bloody hell?
Rake says, looking at me agog. Half his hair is sticking out to one side and there's a bit of drool at the corner of his mouth.
Are you dead?
Good morning, gentlemen, I say. We thought someone had been shot, Hubert says. Someone was about to be. Fournier is the only one who seems to have caught on to what's happening. He isn't smiling exactly, but there is amusement in his eyes.
We thought we were being attacked.
Call them back, I tell Fournier. Every single man who just left. I want everyone in the clearing in 2 minutes. He nods, then whistles clear and loud, and we all tromp back to stand beside the fire pits. I am surrounded by dozens and dozens of men, the vast majority newly woken, and I look at their faces carefully. I can tell who was in those bushes based on who will not meet my gaze. I set my pack on the ground, stow my revolver inside, and speak very clearly in French.
Since we're all together, I'd like to set a few ground rules.
They stare and blink, rub their eyes, scratch their crotches, stretch and yawn. Some look at me suspiciously, others smirk. I'd like to box every single one of their ears.
Fournier is your commanding officer, I say,
my voice loud enough to echo off the trees.
But my colleagues and I are the ones who will supply you with weapons and teach you how to use them. Do you understand?
Heads nod reluctantly.
Along with those weapons will come money for food. Do you understand?
Heads nod, a bit more interested now. I turn in a half circle, trying to make eye contact with as many men as possible.
But if you make me angry, I will not give you weapons, and I will leave you out here to starve. Do you understand?
Heads nod.
It really, really makes me angry when desperate, surchauffé, unwashed little men try to get a glimpse at my bare ass while I pee. Do you understand?
Heads nod emphatically.
I will have my privacy. Do you understand?
Nodding, nodding, nodding. Hubert tries to wrestle his grin into submission, but Rake is positively shaking with mirth.
I will go to the damn toilet in peace. Do you understand?
Heads nod. Fournier chortles out loud. I glare at him and he clears his throat, doing his best to make it seem as though he's coughing.
Follow me into the bushes again, and I will shoot you twice, once in the bollocks and once in the skull. Do you fucking understand?
Heads nod once more.
Good. Now get out of my sight.
They flee like their own mothers were after them with a switch, and before long it's only myself, Fournier, Rake, and Hubert left around the burned-out fire. At least the horse carcass has been removed.
I am tired and hungry and cold, I say, and I swear if any of you teases me about this, I'll kill you too.
Hubert shrugs. I actually thought it was quite impressive. Rake nods. Eyes glinting.
My own bollocks crawled right up inside my body. I'll have to go through puberty again so they'll drop.
Shut up!
I laugh, and then stop because that makes me need to go even worse. I need their respect, not their lust, and I can't have both. I turn and walk away.
Where are you going? Rake shouts after me. To pee. I'm about to explode.
And they do laugh then, but I don't fault them for it given that my walk has turned into a waddle with the urgency of my mission.
If anyone comes within 50 feet of that stream, shoot them.
You have my word, ducky,
Rake shouts, but he's laughing so hard he almost chokes on the last word.
Nancy Grace Augusta Wake. Nancy's flat, Rue Sainte Anne, Paris, January 1937.
Well, Stephanie says, drawing on her cigarette, I hope you haven't been sending him love letters. Women do stupid things like that after sex.
I fold a black pencil skirt and set it carefully into my suitcase.
How many times do I have to tell you that I did not sleep with Henri Fioca?
She rolls her eyes.
Oh, I am certain there was no sleeping involved.
Let me be as clear as I can. We are not having sex.
But you've been seeing him for months.
Yes, so?
Isn't that the way of things? She asks.
Stephanie sits curled up in the small wingback chair in my bedroom. The velvet is faded and it's threadbare, but I'm certain there is no more comfortable seat in all of Paris than right there at my window, with the sun shining through the frosted panes.
Often, yes.
My favorite green cashmere sweater goes into the suitcase next, and I smooth out the creases so it will arrive unwrinkled. The color sets off my eyes, and the wide neckline flatters my jaw. But it's the softness of the thing, like a rabbit's underbelly, that I'm certain will have Henri Fioca purring in my ear when I see him tomorrow. Stephanie blows smoke out her nose, looking for all the world like the concept of not bedding a man has set her brain on fire.
Ma petite, say what you like to him, especially on the pillow, but never put it in writing. He will hold you to it forever otherwise.
She's the one who brought up pillows, so I grab one from my bed and throw it at her head, but she ducks it easily, laughing. I've had many conversations with Henri Fioca, but none of them have involved pillows.
That's how the Count got me, you know,
she continues, ignoring me completely.
He swept me off my feet, bought me flowers and wine and perfume. He sent me letters, took me to Italy. Of course I responded, declared my love in return. And now whenever I behave badly, he waves those letters in my face. How am I supposed to take a lover like a proper Frenchwoman when he's constantly reminding me of my oaths of undying fidelity?
Stephanie loves Count Gonzales, I know she does. And she remains staunchly faithful to him. But I am now uncertain whether that's by choice. I have sent exactly zero love letters to Henri Fioca, I say in complete honesty. However, I do not mention that we speak at great length on the phone several times per week. Stephanie is unimpressed.
And yet here you are packing your suitcase to travel south yet again. How many times is this in the last 4 months?
Four. She looks at me with those unnerving blue eyes.
And you will no doubt be staying at the Hotel de l'Uvepe, like I always do. With a guest, no doubt.
Unless you mean Picon, no. Fioca has his own flat. Somewhere. I've never been there. Stephanie tosses her cigarette onto the floor and grinds it out with the toe of her shoe.
And why not? She demands. What is wrong with you?
Well, for starters, he's never invited me. She opens her mouth to interrupt again, but I stop her. Nor has he invited himself up to my room. And yes, I bloody well know that I could do the inviting on both counts, but I just... Here, I struggle to explain myself.
Feel like there's nothing wrong with being... ridiculous? Hard to get.
I continue packing my suitcase.
That man could have any woman in Marseille. Have you looked at him? He could have any woman in France.
She shakes her head.
I despair of you ever becoming a proper Parisienne.
I stab a finger at her.
That's my point exactly, don't you see? In this one instance, I'd like to be different. If he wants me, he has to work for it. I won't make it easy for him. He could be seeing 10 different women while he's waiting on you, she says.
If so, I'll find out, and that will be the end.
I suppose this is possible. Henri Fjocka doesn't lack for opportunity. But something tells me he isn't running around on me. Or maybe I am deluded. Regardless, I have a train to catch, a city to visit, and a story to find. The Hearst newspaper group will be expecting an article of some sort next week, and given the calm political climate in Marseille at the moment, I will have to get creative to find one. For months, I've been taking any opportunity that presents itself to travel south. It couldn't be more obvious to Stephanie, or anyone else halfway paying attention for that matter, that I am practically hurling myself toward Marseille and Henri every chance I get. To be fair, however, he's doing the same. Paris is landlocked, but you'd think it was the center of the shipping universe the way he makes excuses to travel north for work. Thankfully, he has no one to answer to but his father. Stephanie stretches, then picks a piece of tobacco from her tongue.
Trust me, ma petite. Whisper your promises. Don't mail them.
Fine words from the woman who got me into this mess in the first place, I say, slamming the lid of my suitcase a little harder than necessary. She grins now, and I see how delighted she really is about my growing love affair.
You're welcome.
Verdun's Restaurant, Marseille.
Please don't be angry with me, Henri says the next night as he pulls out my chair.
He sets his hands on my shoulders, thumbs caressing the soft green sweater. He drops a kiss to one cheek. I straighten my spine, but don't shake off his hands.
Why should I be angry?
I've invited someone to join us for dinner.
Who?
A whisper in my ear.
My father.
Your...
I didn't tell you because I didn't want you to be nervous.
Henri chooses the chair to my left instead of the one across from me.
I thought you didn't want me to be angry.
That either.
Then you can't spring something like this on me.
To be fair, this is a first. Besides, I was afraid you wouldn't come if you knew he'd be here.
You were correct.
Honestly, if he'd told me we were having dinner with Satan himself, I would have come. We're eating at Verdun's tonight. It's my favorite restaurant in Marseille, or at least the ones we've been to so far. It is warm and elegant, white linens and candlelight, and the food is nothing short of a religious experience. I won't admit this, however. I'd rather Henri think I'm upset. Who brings a girl to meet his father and doesn't warn her first?
Henri takes a quick, deep breath and huffs it out. Listen, he wants to meet you. He's been asking.
I go to Paris a lot. He knows it's for a woman. And I'd like you to meet him as well.
Why?
Because we're not like the other relationships I've had.
I won't smile. I will not smile. Henri Fjocka cannot have the satisfaction of knowing how pleased I am by those words. He can't know how desperately I want to be special, to be the one he chooses. So I scowl at him instead. It's the only way to mask the pure elation that I feel.
Merde, there he is, Henri says.
I catch the warning in his eyes, that sudden flash of surprise, just before he stands. Henri's father is not alone. I follow his gaze and take in the couple who have just stepped inside the front door of Verdun's. The man is clearly Henri's father. They are identical. Same height, same build, same handsome face, though Henri's is a good 30 years younger. His father's hair is salt and pepper to Henri's black. His laugh lines are deeper, his body softer, but they are one and the same, cut from the same expensive cloth. The woman at his side, however, cannot be Henri's mother. That is... I search for the name of the woman I met here 5 months ago.
Marceline, Henri says.
I've never heard him use this cold voice before, and it has my full attention. I return my gaze to him and note the clenched jaw,
the single furious twitch of his upper lip. Why?
I don't know, he hisses. But I am sorry. I didn't know and she wasn't invited.
By you?
Certainly not.
Okay, I can live with that. And I'll have to, because Joseph, the maitre d', is leading them toward our table. They are 20 feet away. 10, 5. We are standing, and I have summoned a half-hearted smile for the occasion. All teeth, but no sincerity. I don't think of myself as the sort of woman who gets nervous. But here I am, heart pounding, as Henri introduces me to his father.
This is Nancy, he says,
setting my hand gently into his father's. Pleased to meet you. My voice sounds hollow, insincere, and I can see his eyes narrow.
Ranier Fioca, he says.
But my brain records him simply as Old Man Fioca. It's the only way to distinguish him from Henri. They are too similar. He drops my hand without shaking it in return or pressing a customary kiss to the knuckles. I feel as though I have been measured and found wanting.
And Marceline?
Henri adds, the frost heavy in his voice as he looks at his father.
Though I must admit I was not expecting a fourth party. I invited her, he says.
I see. They glower at each other and I extend my hand to Marceline as father and son engage in a silent battle of wills.
We've met, she says,
glancing at my hand but not taking it.
Have you?
Old man Fioca looks from his son to Marceline, then to me.
Where exactly was that?
I take my seat and Henri joins me. He moves close enough that the entire lengths of our thighs touch. His hand is on my knee. A comfort. A warning. I don't give Henri a chance to answer his father. I am too angry, too blisteringly angry at him for putting me in this situation, to give him the opportunity to smooth this over.
Well, the last time we saw one another, she was in the company of your son.
Of all the things I expect Old Man Fioca to do, laugh is not one of them. But he does, loud and startling.
Was she? I am glad to hear it. It's been too long since they spent time together.
I agree.
Marceline's voice is a purr, but not a lioness. Hers is the voice of a jackal, one who takes her blood straight from the jugular. And her eyes are on me, looking for weakness.
Henri and I have a long history.
Our waiter arrives to take our drink order, and we all in unison request brandy. No water, no wine, we're going straight to the liquor. If our waiter is nervous, if he feels the boiling tension surrounding our small corner table, he doesn't let on. But then Old Man Fioca looks at me with a calculating glint.
Bring a bottle of Bollinger Cuvée Brut as well.
Oui, monsieur,
our waiter says, then retreats at a fast clip toward the kitchen. The scent of baking bread and seared steak fills the restaurant, along with the rich aroma of bouillabaisse. Normally this would make my mouth water, but my stomach is a bag of knots instead, coiled and tight. Marceline has chosen the seat directly across from Henri, putting herself on display. She shimmies out of her fur coat, revealing a brown satin blouse unbuttoned to a deep, almost immoral, V. I can see her clavicles and sternum clearly, along with the inner curve of each breast. It's cold. It's January, for Pete's sake. But there she is, no brassiere, nipples evident against the thin fabric. A delicate gold necklace rests along her collarbones. A pendant, in the form of the letter H, sits gently in the hollow, and she touches it lightly with one finger.
Oh, now I see what's happening.
H. Henri. She has staked her claim, and Old Man Fioca approves. To him, I am the unwanted guest, the interloper. and what better way to drive me off than to bring one of Henri's old flames to our first meeting?
Marceline situates her coat over the back of her chair, smiles gently at old man Fiocca, smiles seductively at Henri. But it's the smile she gives me that is vindictive. She remembers what happened at our last meeting and is out for blood, is desperate for it, in fact. Given the look on her face, I can see how clearly she has imagined this moment, planned for it, which means she is likely behind this entire fiasco. So I give her a single nod. "I see you," it says, "and I will not be driven off." I am not the sort of woman who waits for the attack, so I'm drawing a breath about to speak when old man Fiocca asks,
"Where exactly are you from, Mademoiselle?"
"Wake," I say, taking a second to recalibrate. "I was born in New Zealand, but raised in Australia."
"Not Francais."
He gives Henri a disapproving glance as though beginning a list of my faults.
"And what is it that you do?"
"I am a journalist."
"Is that so?"
I nod.
"And what do you cover?"
"Politics mostly, but also current affairs, and sports occasionally. I covered the Olympics last year in Berlin." If this were a different conversation and he a different sort of man, I would tell him what it felt like to stand in that stadium and watch Jesse Owens beat Adolf Hitler's best runners to win the gold medal, and then what it felt like afterward to interview the son of black sharecroppers from Alabama, knowing that he had just changed the world. I would tell him about standing in the shadow of the Hindenburg as it passed over the field, an engineering marvel desecrated by the black swastika painted on its sides. If he had come to meet me instead of to chase me away, I would tell him any number of things, not the least of which is how enamored I am of his son. As expected, he is unimpressed.
"And which French newspaper do you work for?"
"Not a single one," I say.
"Pardon?"
"I'm a freelancer. I work for the European Bureau of the Hearst newspaper group."
"Hearst?"
he says, as though he's really saying maggot or feces.
"They are American?"
"Yes."
"I am familiar with that tabloid."
The one thing I can tolerate about Marceline, the single feature on her entire beautifully smug face, is the fact that she does not have a perfect smile. There is an overlap in her two front teeth, just a small imperfection. So when she flashes her triumphant grin, it is slightly warped. I do not need Henri to defend me, and the fact that he doesn't makes me love him all the more. Yes, I love him. I cannot help it. I realized this at the train station today. He found me and kissed me on the platform in full view of every person there. And then he dug around in my handbag for Picon and kissed him too, right on the nose. Picon returned his affection with a lick right on the chin, and I thought my poor, battered heart might explode from the joy of it all. My little dog is asleep in my hotel room on a cushion that Henri Fiocca bought for him. It is purple velvet with black piping, and Picon looks like a monarch perched right there in the center, like the bloody King of England. So old man Fiocca and Marceline can say or do what they please, because I have everything I've ever wanted. I turn to Marceline, change the subject. "And what do you do?"
"She's a secretary,"
old man Fiocca answers for her.
"For who?"
"Albert Paquet,"
she says, as though I ought to know who this is.
"Police Commissioner Paquet,"
old man Fiocca clarifies. I ignore him and continue looking at her.
"It must not pay well."
"Why do you say that?"
she asks. I nod at her décolletage. "Apparently you can't even afford a brassiere." Marceline goes perfectly still, lips parted slightly as though surprised. And I suppose she is. Most French women employ subtlety in their battles, death by a thousand paper cuts. Whereas I prefer a direct attack. Piss or get off the pot.
It takes her a moment to rally, and I can see her eyes hardening, her thoughts gathering, when old man Fjoka laughs. The sound is one of delight. He believes my barb to be the opening bell in a boxing match, and he leans forward, eager to see what will happen next. Once, when I was a very young teen in Sydney, one of my older brothers took me to a seedy part of town. It was a dare, just a way to pass the time on a boring Saturday afternoon. But we went to an establishment where women wrestled one another, barely clothed, while covered in oil like greased pigs. We didn't stay long, and in truth, I didn't understand the point of the entire situation at the time. It took many years of puzzled contemplation to figure out that some men enjoy watching women fight. If they expose themselves in the process, even better. Looking at him now, at the pure, fiendish pleasure in his eyes, I am certain that old man Fjoka would have very much enjoyed that wrestling match. Hell, he's tried to set one up tonight. Our waiter returns with brandy and champagne on ice. He pops the cork and evenly pours the golden bubbling liquid in four separate flutes. But I reach for my brandy and don't even wait to see if old man Fjoka will offer a toast before I take my first sip. Henri's hand settles onto my knee again, and I think it might be a warning. But this is a war I am determined to win. Henri leans to his left, and I hear him whisper, "May I have a word with you outside, Papa?" Old man Fjoka nods.
"Oui."
Henri stands, then kisses me lightly on my forehead.
"If you will excuse us for a moment."
I watch them weave their way through the tables toward the front door, marveling that a man's gait is something that can be inherited, for the two men walk exactly the same. Once they're out of earshot, I turn back to Marceline. "Whose idea was this, yours or his?" She looks at me down the straight line of her nose.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"How about we make a pact? No lies and no feigned stupidity?" Her mouth curls into a feral smile.
"I do not make pacts with foreigners."
"So, your idea then, okay. Seems risky, why bother?" Marceline takes a moment to reassess the situation. I'm not going to play by the typical rules, and once she makes peace with this fact, she leans across the table, her expression that of a jilted lover.
"Because Henri is mine."
I can't help but laugh. "Not anymore." She dismisses me with a flick of her wrist.
"You're nothing but a distraction, a fling. Henri will come back to me. He always does. Unlike you, he knows his place."
I would like to toss the rest of my brandy in her face, but I take a sip instead. "His place? I take it you mean with a French woman?"
"With this French woman."
"And he gets no say in this?" She snorts.
"Henri will do what his father tells him."
"I suspect you are quite wrong about that. Otherwise, he wouldn't be standing out in the cold scolding his father for bringing you tonight."
"If I were ice, Marceline would melt me. If I were fire, she would squelch me.
As it stands, I am flesh and bone, and she is powerless to do a thing about my presence, in this restaurant or in Henri's life." We are throwing daggers at each other with our eyes when Henri and his father return to the table. Henri settles into his seat and slides his hand up my thigh until he finds my slip, then plays with the lace edge.
"Forgive our rudeness," he says. "Just a bit of business that needed to be addressed."
Old man Fjoka looks at Henri, then at me.
"I've not yet heard how you met my son."
"Here in Marseille, at Le Bar de la Marine. A mutual friend introduced us."
"What friend?" he asks.
"A very private one. I will not bring Stephanie into this. I think Henri's father would like her very much, but she wouldn't like being hounded by him, nor would Count Gonzalez."
"Funny. You never mentioned this."
Henri takes a sip of his brandy.
"You can ask Marceline. She was there." I suspect the entire evening made quite an impression on her.
For all their apparent similarities, Henri is made of sterner stuff than his father. He stares at old man Fiocca, daring him to continue. And we all sit there in that silence, waiting to see who will speak first, when the waiter arrives once more to take our orders for dinner.
Coq au vin, I say, without even looking at the menu. This must have been what Marceline wanted, because she looks at me as though I am a physical manifestation of the Black Plague.
Ratatouille, she snaps.
Old man Fiocca tersely gives his order.
Boeuf bourguignon.
The waiter looks at Henri.
And you, monsieur?
Sole meunière.
I like to think that Henri will stab his father with the bones of that fish.
I am curious about one more thing, old man Fiocca says.
What is that? I ask.
What exactly do you see in my son?
Oh, that is quite simple. There is only a finger of brandy left in my glass, and I swallow it in one smooth gulp. I haven't even touched my champagne, but I'll break the fingers of anyone who tries to stop me from drinking that next.
Your son is a gentleman and a gentle man, whereas you, sir, are an ass.
Henri. Come, ma chère, Henri says. I think it is time you learn to drink. I'm not thirsty, she snaps, yanking her arm away. That's not what I meant. They stand on the sidewalk outside Verdun's, and she has her back to the window. Little clouds of frozen air drift from her nostrils in angry puffs. But the street lamps are on, and they bathe her face in golden light, making even her fury look angelic. Henri can see his father and Marceline inside the restaurant, at the table where they left them, glaring. He returns the hostile stare until they turn back to their dessert. The January air has an edge tonight, unseasonably cold, and Nancy belts her coat tighter around her waist. Her hands are shaking in anger, and he can't blame her. He brought this disaster on himself.
What did you mean, then? She asks.
You've got thimble guts.
What?
You're a lightweight, love. One drink and you go under. It will never do. My father did it on purpose.
Why?
To get you talking. To make you angry.
Well, it worked.
Perhaps, but it didn't have the intended effect. You're still here.
He watches her sway slightly on her feet.
I'd hate to see it happen again, though, by him or anyone else.
How long has it been since you and Marceline were lovers?
Ah, I see the two of you had a talk as well. He traces her jaw with the tip of one finger. Many years. I ended it.
But you were with her the night we met.
He nods. I was bored and lonely, and she wore me down. But I don't regret being there. I wouldn't have met you otherwise.
Good answer. But you're going to have to work harder than that to smooth this over.
He laughs. I'm trying. Now will you come with me, please?
Henri offers his arm, and after a moment Nancy accepts, tucking her fingers inside the bend of his elbow. Where are we going? She asks.
To my favorite bar. First, I will sober you up, and then I will try to get you astonishingly drunk. Your job is to thwart me.
Sounds like a boxing match with my liver.
It's a game, actually.
And if I succeed?
He winks. Then I will take you straight up to your room and let you have your way with me.
Up.
Henri gives her a mischievous grin. Ah, ma chère, this bar is located quite conveniently inside your hotel. Marseille is a city offended by the mere suggestion of winter. She was built to be enjoyed at dusk during the height of summer, wine glass in hand, freckles bright from a day in the sun,
not hustled through on a cold January night, and yet there is still an irrefutable charm clinging to her cobblestones and dormant vines. She is an old-world city, boasting good bones and expensive taste. Age has refined her, Henri thinks, and her stately buildings do not crack or crumble. Below them is the harbor, ships tucked in for the night, and above them the Basilica of Notre-Dame de la Garde, lit up like a beacon on the hill. Street lamps and shop windows bathe the city in amber light. It bounces off the water in the old stone walls. Everything is blue and gold, regal. The night air stings his eyes as they walk toward the Vieux Port, huddled close for warmth, but Henri turns his face to the sky and sees that it too is magnificent. Black velvet and white diamonds. His mind drifts toward the landscape of Nancy's body, and he almost misses his turn onto the Canebière, distracted by thoughts of black velvet and white diamonds lying across her collarbone. Soon, the four grand caryatids at the entrance of the Hôtel du Louvre-Épée are before them, and he guides her across the street and toward the doors. As he does every time he steps inside the hotel, Henri marvels at the intricacy of the sculptures. Each holds an animal in her marble hands, a sphinx, an elephant, a dromedary, and a fish. He's always thought they are a portent of something, good or evil, but he doesn't know what. Tonight, he's hoping for good. Henri situates them at the bar instead of the more popular and brightly lit lobby. There are stumpy candles set at intervals along its length, giving the room a warmth the lobby chandeliers cannot rival. He inches his stool closer to Nancy so that their thighs touch, and he drops his hand to her knee, squeezing it once with affection. "First rule of drinking," Henri says, "is mind your temperature." Nancy tilts her chin to the side in question. He wants to run his finger along her jaw, but resists, focusing on the task at hand instead.
"It's a bad combination, drinking too much and being too warm. You'll go right to sleep. Open a window or take off your coat, but mind your temperature at all times."
"I'm beginning to suspect you're just trying to get my clothes off, Fiocca," she says, but shrugs out of her coat and drapes it across the back of the chair anyway.
"That comes later, ma chère," he winks, "assuming you win this little game of ours."
After a moment, the barman comes to take their order.
"Antoine," Henri says, "this is Nancy."
Antoine is too handsome for his own good. Trouble is, he knows it. Thankfully, he is also short, and at least 3 decades older than Nancy. He takes her offered hand and turns it over gently, kissing her palm.
"Any friend of Henri's is a friend of mine. You are most welcome to anything in this establishment."
The way he says the word anything makes it clear that he includes himself in the offer.
"As you can see," Henri continues with a scowl, "Antoine is Corsican and therefore a complete reprobate." "You insult me," he says, still stroking Nancy's hand seductively.
"I tell the truth."
Henri shakes his head. Corsicans.
"I see that you two are well acquainted."
Nancy glances between them with suspicion. "I assume Henri brings all his women here?"
"You are the first that I've met, mademoiselle."
She laughs.
"You have your barman well trained, Fiocca."
He's affronted by her use of his last name, the second time tonight. At least she's dropped the mister. She uses it only when trying to put emotional distance between them.
"You persist in your poor opinion of me. I have brought no other women here."
Antoine releases her hand with a sigh of faux reluctance.
"And what will you be drinking tonight?" "First, ice water,"
Henri says, and then two fingers of cognac each. We'll take... He thinks for a moment. Gautier, leave us the bottle. Antoine limps away and begins to scoop hard nuggets of ice into two tumblers. He once told Henri that there is still shrapnel in his left thigh from the Great War, but he also told him that it was an injury sustained while vigorously exercising in a Milanese brothel. Henri has made peace with the fact that the story of Antoine's limp may never be known, but he sees Nancy eyeing the barman curiously and wouldn't be surprised if she wrestles the truth out of him one day. He expects her to say something about the limp, but instead she asks, "An entire bottle of brandy?" "Don't worry. I doubt we'll get through the whole thing." "So why ask for it?"
"We'll be here a while, and there's no need to make him shuffle back and forth."
She smiles at him. "You do surprise me sometimes, Fiocca. Here I thought you were jealous of the man."
"Jealous?"
"Well, your barman is quite handsome, and you got that pinched look around your eyes when he kissed my hand."
"He practically licked your hand."
"The one you get sometimes. It's charming, really." She brushes one warm finger against his lower lip. Henri is surprised to find heat creeping into his cheeks. It's been years, decades, maybe, since a woman made him blush. He is pleased that she is pleased. So he shrugs.
"I like the old salo."
As if summoned, Antoine sets the water in front of them and is off again to locate the Gautier in his vast brandy collection. Henri leans close to give Nancy instructions on this game they'll be playing.
"Drink the water steadily in several long gulps. It will cool you down and shake the cobwebs from your brain. Once you stop slurring, we'll move on to the brandy."
"I am not slurring."
He winks. "Au contraire, your tongue has been moving quite slow for the last hour."
She sticks her tongue out at this, and he laughs.
"Get your mind on the game, ma chère, not the victory."
"You have no idea where my mind is."
"Quite happily frolicking about the gutter, I'd say."
Nancy doesn't even attempt to deny it. She's been staring at his mouth since they left the restaurant.
"Drink up," he orders, and for once, she complies. After a moment, he adds, "The second rule of drinking is don't cross streams. I know we've already had a bit of champagne, but we'll be sticking with brandy for the rest of the night."
"And the third rule?" she asks.
"How do you know there's a third?"
"You always do things in threes."
"A very astute observation for a tipsy woman."
"I'm not tipsy."
"Not anymore. The water is working, isn't it?"
Nancy nods.
"Told you so. And that brings us to our third rule."
"I knew it."
"Stay hydrated. For every glass of brandy, drink a tumbler of water. Water will dilute the alcohol in your bloodstream, and it will send you to the bathroom frequently. Both are vital when you're learning to build up your tolerance. There are other rules, but we'll stick with those three for now."
"Just out of curiosity, why go with brandy?"
"Apart from wine, it's the most commonly imbibed liquid in France, and it's mostly what you drank at dinner. Besides, you're more likely to be offered brandy than anything else."
"So?"
"So? No man trying to take advantage of you is going to pour wine down your throat. Brandy is cheaper and works faster."
"And what if a woman wants to take advantage of you, Fiocca?"
"Oh, that's easy."
Nancy leans close enough to brush her cheek against his as she whispers in his ear. "Tell me how." He swallows hard.
"You're doing it right now."
Henri grabs Nancy's hand when she moves it to his thigh and sets it back on her lap. He pats her fingers to lessen the sting.
Focus, ma chère. This is important.
One of the things Henri loves most about this woman is that she is not naturally inclined to do as she's told, but she must sense his determination, so she applies herself to the task. Henri wonders if this is how she approached the world at 16, alone and hungry for adventure, because she goes from shameless flirting to intense focus faster than he can register. Then, they begin to drink. 2 hours later, Henri pays Antoine and helps Nancy to her feet.
That's enough for one night, ma fille qui rit.
Nancy looks up at him with glassy, adoring eyes. It's the same look she gave him the night he left her alone in bed, and it's quickly becoming one of his favorite expressions. It is both innocent and imploring.
Did I lose? She asks.
No, it was a draw.
Liar, you're perfectly upright and I can barely stand.
He laughs and nuzzles the top of her head with his chin.
Patience, ma chère. It takes time. I've been punishing my liver for years.
The truth is, she did quite well. Purposeful drinking and social drinking are different, and she applied herself with verve. They consumed half the bottle of Gautier between them, taking it neat and in steady intervals. She's wobbling a bit as they head to the elevator, and her tongue is heavy on the vowels, but she would be on the floor already without his rules. To be fair, Henri isn't faring much better. His vision is fuzzy around the edges, and he feels as though the room is spinning.
Does this mean I won't be able to have my way with you tonight? She asks.
Henri laughs long and hard as the elevator rises to the top floor. He pulls her against him and rests his chin on top of her head.
I doubt you'll be awake long enough to get to the fun part.
Try me, she says.
Marseille, Hôtel de l'UVP. I can feel Henri begin to haul himself in like he always does, pausing just short of any serious sexual advance. He doesn't pull away or stop touching me. It's simply a palpable restraint, a force of will shimmering in the air between us. Mon Dieu, I love this sweater, Henri says, rubbing his nose along the ridge of my collarbone. His hands slide up my ribcage, thumbs stopping just below the swell of my breasts. He buries his face in my neck, nuzzles, inhales. And your perfume? I'm not wearing perfume, but I did think you might like the sweater. Tell me where you bought it and I will get you 5 more, one in every color. His voice is a rumble against my skin, his tongue a whisper in the dip of my clavicle. We are on the couch in the sitting room of my suite, addled from brandy and exhaustion, and I think it wouldn't be hard to tear down these defenses of his. An invitation, perhaps, a strategic shift in my body below his. But Henri prefers me direct and to the point. Will you stay the night? I ask. He stretches out on his side and pulls me close so that we are facing each other. I can feel his eyelashes against my face. He kisses me, gentle at first and then deep. His left hand trails down my side, over my ribs, into the dip of my waist, across the swell of my backside and down the back of my thigh. He crooks his hand behind my knee and brings my stocking-covered leg over the top of his. He plays with my slip, my garter. For one delicious moment, I think that I've gotten my way. And then he says, Non, ma chère. But soon. His breath is warm in my ear, his hand dipping beneath the hem of my sweater, his fingers trailing across my spine, up and down, gentle, methodic. He is lulling me to sleep. But
I argue again.
I won the drinking game.
It was a tie. Let's both get what we want then.
I wriggle closer and he laughs, wraps both arms tight across my shoulders.
Henri Fjocka is a big man, tall and broad with a deep, commanding voice. And though my pride stings, am I not desirable enough? I don't stand a chance. I am so perfectly warm and safe and happy in this moment, so groggy from a long emotional evening, from hating old man Fjocka while falling madly for his son, that I simply drift away right here. And I know that sometime tomorrow, when the sun is high in the sky, I will wake alone.